Hi, everyone. My name is Anthony Negron, host and producer of Spark Chat, a podcast dedicated to capturing and sharing the personal and professional journeys of some of New York City's top thought leaders around education. We look to cover an assortment of topics while highlighting each individual. This podcast is generously supported by the Hive New York City Leadership Grant. On this episode, I'm joined by Ari Mogos, a longtime friend and true inspiration. Stay tuned to after the show for additional content. Hope you enjoy. So we're really excited to have our next guest on this podcast, Ariam Mogos. I've known her for a very long time, good friend. Ariam is a learning technologist, a designer, an educator, and a social activist working at the intersection of education, human rights, and global development. Currently working as the learning lead with UNICEF Innovation, she was previously the Director of Digital Learning and Leadership for Global Kids and an active member of the Hive NYC Learning Network. Ariam is also the founder of the Nairobi Play Project, a creating computing initiative that equips urban refugee youth with 21st century skills while supporting their integration into Kenyan society. Ariam, you bring such a positive mindset, hard work ethic, and deep care into everything you do, and it's an absolute pleasure having you as a guest today.
Thank you so much, Anthony. It's so great to be here today and to be at NYSI. I have really fond memories of this place and some of the work that we used to do together when we were part of the Hive Learning Network. So it's really great to be here.
Awesome. And we're actually going to take a trip down memory lane even before when you're young Aria. So as kind of most of these episodes begin, we like to kind of take a step back and kind of reflect on our kind of upbringing. And could you share with us, what were you like as a young kid and what were some of your hobbies?
Yeah, so I was a really big dreamer. I still am.
Yeah.
And a big dreamer in the sense that I always wanted to try different things. I was interested in a lot of things and curious about a lot of things. I really loved art and reading. I was really passionate about music. I played violin throughout my childhood. So was really heavily involved in the arts growing up. Mm-hmm. I also liked to write a lot, and then also played sports. So I did a lot of different things growing up.
Yeah.
But I was always, I would always try different things and test them and see if I enjoyed them. And if I didn't, I would try something else and try something else, which sometimes would be problematic because I wouldn't stick with one thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. And was there anything, though, that, like, stood out to you that really maybe, I don't want to say had a big impact or just something that you really kind of gravitate towards?
Yeah, I would definitely say music. Music is and was a very big part of my childhood and just important to me as an adult. I think when I was younger, it was a very natural and easy way for me to express myself.
Yeah.
So I was in orchestra all through my childhood. I played some jazz violin, and then I also played a little bit of violin in college, mm-hmm. and that became a little bit challenging. But I'll never forget when I think I was a senior in high school, I had an English teacher who was offering an elective around Shakespeare. And I took this Shakespeare class, and there were only two assignments, and they were essays.
Yeah.
And, you know, by senior year, I was just really tired of writing papers. Sure. I was like, I don't want to do this. So I had asked him for my final assignment if I could actually just compose an original piece of music. And I was like, why not? I'm a senior. This is my last year. Yeah. I just want to do something different. He said yes. So I composed an original piece of music, and I had a music tutor that I had for many years helped me with it. And it was the first time I'd actually, you know, created a classical piece of music to sort of express a narrative related to one of Shakespeare's plays, which was really challenging, but it was amazing that I had a teacher that actually gave me, kind of respected my interest.
Right.
And knowing me, he knew that I was a musician, and he respected that, and he gave me the space to just experiment and try.
That's awesome.
And that really boosted my confidence. It wasn't like completely finished. It wasn't perfect, and I knew that. Mm-hmm. But I had a friend of mine who was in orchestra with me, who's now actually a professional violinist with the Bergen Philharmonic in Norway. And she, at the time, I made her come in and play it for the class, and she was like, "This is impossible. What did you like compose?" But it was just, I always treasure that experience. Because music was always a way that I really wanted to express myself, and I could do that in any way.
Did you have any musicians, professionals that you drew inspiration from?
So I had a really sort of quirky taste in music.
Okay.
My mother just was so confused.
Okay.
I grew up really obsessed with a lot of different types of music. I liked jazz growing up, so I liked Grant Green and Miles Davis, and but then I liked pop music too.
Yeah.
And I really had an obsession with Tori Amos for a while.
Okay.
I actually told my dad, hey dad, there's this classical pianist who's playing in New York. Mm-hmm. Can we get tickets? I just wanted him to buy the tickets so that we could go to the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when we went to the show, he was so mad at me.
Oh, no.
Because this is not the type of music he enjoyed. I had a Tori Amos phase and Kate Bush. And so, there were a lot of sort of female musicians that I really admired and jazz musicians. I really sort of all types of music, really.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. What were some different, being a dreamer growing up,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you went through maybe different phases where you wanted to go down this career path or that career path.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what are some of those, options that you thought maybe that would be something for you when you got older?
Yeah. So when I was younger, I told my parents I was going to be a surgeon.
Okay.
And then, that obviously didn't happen, and I had no interest in doing that by the time I left high school. When I was in college, that's when I studied labor relations, so I was really learning a lot about the labor movement.
Right.
And that's really where, that time, and high school also, that was really my time, though, in college is when I was really thinking about social movements and social justice and how I could build some type of career in this sort of social justice space, but somehow exploring the arts, that was always really important to me. And so when I finished college, I moved to LA, and I had a couple years where I was just trying to make films, and that was really interesting.
Yeah.
And I totally failed, and I made a couple projects that I was really proud of, and they were small and short films, and but I got to just test and experiment and, really had the opportunity to express myself.
Sure. And,
but then I realized this is something that is not something I really want to do as a full-time career because it's really challenging.
Right.
So I came back to New York, and there were a lot of things I thought about. I thought about law at some point because I was in debate team in high school, and I loved to debate.
Yeah.
But then that really wasn't something I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I just realized, it's a lot of paperwork
all the
time.
Yeah. Right.
And then I got this job at the American Museum of Natural History because I had some work experience in design and technology before that.
Okay.
So I got this job in the education section working on a digital learning program.
Awesome.
And at that point, when I first started that project, my role was really on the design and technology side.
Uh-huh.
But then over time, I was really working very closely with the educators at the museum.
Okay.
And then I sort of slowly just fell into finding my passion for learning.
Yeah.
And where design and technology can sort of play a role to amplify learning.
Awesome.
So that's really where I am now, I'd say, is really where that began. But I think there were times in my childhood, if I reflect back, where I think, having teachers who sort of respected my interests and gave me the space to explore my creativity. When I look back, I think the way that they gave me that space made me realize sort of how important that is.
Yeah. Are there any educators in the family, in your family?
My uncle is a professor at Hunter.
Okay.
A professor of physics.
Okay.
So he's an educator.
Did he give you any advice or?
Not really, because he works with college students.
Right.
So it's a little bit, sort of different demographic. But
Cool. And I know, like, your career within education and kind of youth development is so rich, and so we're really excited to kind of dive deep into that. So I want to make sure that we allocate a good amount of time to talk about your development of the Nairobi Play Project. I want to know a little bit more about kind of the inspiration in creating the initiative, and can you talk about kind of what the initiative aims to tackle and how does it plan on accomplishing that?
Sure. So it started, I was living in Kenya a couple years ago working for a small NGO sort of in the digital learning skills space, and my family is East African, my parents are from Eritrea, and there are a lot of Eritrean refugees in Kenya. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that in Nairobi there were so many Eritrean refugees. I was a little bit surprised when I first got there.
Yeah.
And so I just started like meeting some of them while I was there and talking to them, and they just started telling me what sort of like life was in Kenya, like how challenging it was to get employment. Just like there weren't good educational opportunities. Just like it's just a very difficult life.
Yeah.
And so I just started thinking about, was there anything that I could do as a member of the diaspora? Like, was there something that I could do to at least sort of help or support, my community?
Right.
And so that's sort of where this project came together. It's a creative computing initiative that supports the integration of refugees into Kenyan society. Mm. And really it's about, so I thought about taking what I know how to do, which is like making these rich learning experiences.
Yeah.
And using that as a tool to sort of help bridge, create bridges between communities.
Right.
So for refugees, a lot of these educational programs are very siloed. That's one thing I learned when mm-hmm. I was in Kenya.
Yeah.
So like if communities aren't interacting, if they're not talking, you know,
right.
obviously it's going to be really hard
sure.
to integrate.
Yeah.
So I thought, what if I could design, you know, just like a small pilot that was super low cost, like just bootstrap something
yeah.
that was just to test a sort of a program that brought together children from very different communities that don't always interact with each other, and got them to sort of make games about issues in Kenya that they all care about but have very different perspectives. And maybe these are the issues that really create the walls between them.
Right.
And so that's what we did. I did that. I designed a week-long program. And it was very, very interesting to see what happened when the kids came into the program and when they left the program.
Yeah.
And there were definitely friendships that developed throughout that 1 week, and just a much deeper understanding of different cultures and perspectives. And then that 1 week pilot then was picked up by UNICEF Kenya and became like a much bigger pilot project.
Right.
So that project is now running with close to 500 youth in
wow.
Nairobi and Kakuma refugee camp.
And yeah. what's the age?
So we work with adolescents, 14 to 18 years old.
14 to 18.
Yeah.
Cool. Can you talk a little bit about some of the kind of lessons learned or challenges you face in implementing a program like this?
Sure.
Yeah.
So there's the sort of like classic problems when you're working in low resource environments, like
right.
you're not going to have electricity all the time.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to have connectivity. So of course, like we were using Scratch and we were using Scratch offline. So we designed that from the beginning so that
yeah.
we wouldn't have to be internet dependent.
Right.
Because
right.
we knew we were very familiar with the context that we were working in.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greater challenges was we were working with this incredible cohort of teachers who not all of them had experience running any type of sort of digital skills or digital literacy programming.
Okay.
This was their first time.
Wow.
Yeah. And so...
And where did you find these teachers?
So through my implementing partner, Xavier Project.
Okay.
It's an NGO based in Kenya.
Okay.
So for them, it can, you know, be a little bit intimidating,
yeah.
but exciting. So
right.
I was very lucky because I got a group of very excited teachers who were interested in games. But, you know, it was definitely, there was a lot to learn
yeah.
and quite a growing experience. So that's definitely been one of the challenges, but probably I would actually say for me, one of the greatest outcomes of this entire program has been to work with this fantastic cohort of teachers who have grown so much since this started. We did one professional development with them in January and then another one in May.
Yeah.
And to just see where the teachers started and where they are now is incredible.
That's awesome.
So in the second PD, in the first PD, it was more about sort of teaching them the program design and the model and the purpose of the program and like reviewing the curriculum with them and teaching them how to use Scratch and modeling that for them so that they can actually successfully implement the program.
Okay.
The second PD was really about now building their capacity to do this themselves. So like lesson planning, doing facilitation drills with them, because for me, the goal, if I'm thinking about this long term, the goal is not to keep designing curriculum that's handed down to them.
Yeah.
It's about building their capacity to deliver project-based learning themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, the second PD was really about building their capacity to do that, covering areas like educator self-care.
Yeah.
You know, like this is project-based learning can be, I mean, teaching in general can be very draining. You're giving a lot to your students. Like, how are you taking care of yourself? Like, how are you leaning on your co-facilitator?
Right.
How are you communicating with your co-facilitator, if you have one? You know, how are you creating a creative classroom? So there are a lot of different areas that we covered in the second PD.
That's
and
awesome.
Then hopefully we'll have a third PD coming up in which I really want to support them in, well, actually co-design professional development with them that they can then give to others.
Oof.
Yeah, so that we can really make this a sustainable model that can sort of help change education.
That's great. And that definitely seems like the next step.
Yeah.
And there's so much, like, so many programs, like, or like professional development that you can see here in the States where it's like, it's here's the curriculum, you know, you kind of just run it as is and then you kind of, that's it. Like, that's where the kind of the relationship ends and, you know, and they're just left just, that's it. They know that specific curriculum and that's it.
Yeah.
But you're really getting them to kind of think for themselves and how to possibly even integrate something like Scratch into lessons that they're, you know, doing over there, which that's really awesome.
And then another thing is, like, I think for me, what I've really learned about PD or like the approach with this program I've really tried to take is to be as data driven as possible.
Okay.
So one thing I've seen in PDs in the past is kind of like you have one PD, you work with teachers. And I'm talking more about like sort of ed tech PDs, where like they learn the technology, they get the curriculum, and then the second PD is like, then they learn more of the technology.
Mm-hmm.
With this program, what we really actually try to do is we see where the teachers are. So it's not about learning the technology,
right?
It's like we're taking a pedagogy first approach, right? So that they could teach using any tool. It's not about the tool. So
smart.
I think like being data driven in the sense that like as educators, we're always like, know your students. But I think we got to know your teachers too.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's been very important for me in the approach we've been taking through, you know, in building the capacity of our teachers, because otherwise we're not really maximizing the efficiency of the PD.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's been really, really important.
Awesome. And I'm sure you have, like, even the project itself is, you know, you must feel very proud of kind of the genesis of it and kind of where it's going. Is there a specific moment or like an anecdote that you would like to share that?
So there was a teacher in the first PD who she had actually had no teaching experience, I found out.
Okay.
And she was supporting one of the other teachers who was the pretty much the strongest teacher in the cohort.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little concerned.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, you know, let's see.
Yeah.
I have faith, but I'm all the way in New York and she's in Kenya and I'm coming here a few times a year. I hope we've got to get her some support. I just want to make sure she's going to be okay.
Sure.
And we have this awesome WhatsApp group with all the teachers. So we hear from them every day
and
they send photos and we see what's been happening in class and we really encourage them to talk about their challenges and successes and share it. And it's really supposed to be a support network.
Yeah.
So the second PD, we had them over 2 days hack these Scratch cards and create their own original lesson plans and then deliver it over 2 days. So I was blown away in her facilitation drill because it was me and Sarah, who designed the PD with me, who also used to work at Global Kids, actually. Awesome. So she's working with me on the project. We, the two of us, and then the rest of the educators posed the students, and all the teachers had to do facilitation drills. And I mean, it was incredible. She was just, she used so many amazing techniques. She modeled for us. She engaged students based on their interests. She had one student come up and demo something for the class. She just did everything right, and she just did it so well. And this was the teacher that I was concerned about a few months ago.
Right.
And this was the lesson plan that she created. It wasn't something that we gave to her. So just to see that sort of come full circle was just great. Wow. I just was so blown away. I was so happy. And her debrief questions were great. She just, it was terrific.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So I want to now transition a little bit into some of the work you're doing with UNICEF.
Mm-hmm.
And so... can you share with us, kind of talk a little bit about your role there and any specific projects that you would like to highlight that you're currently working on?
Sure. So I am currently the learning lead for UNICEF's Office of Innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Office of Innovation really sort of designs, builds, and helps UNICEF country offices pilot open source technologies across health, education, nutrition, gender, and our other program sections.
Mm-hmm.
So I work really closely with our education section and our disability section. And I work specifically on our innovation fund. So we have a $15 million fund in the Office of Innovation that funds early stage startups in UNICEF program countries.
Okay.
So program countries are would be like Thailand and South Africa. It wouldn't be the US and the UK, for example. So really where we do most of our program work. And so I review the applications that come in that are that fall under our learning and accessibility portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
And then the companies that come onto the fund, I help sort of help them meet their milestones, provide them with technical assistance, support them, connect to mentors and networks that are that would help them in, you know, successfully building and scaling their product.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yeah.
And how long have you been there for?
So about a year and 8 to 9 months.
Awesome. Awesome. Really cool.
Yeah.
Do you have any projects that are kind of coming up that maybe are in its early phases that you're really excited to kind of get on?
Yeah, so I at UNICEF, I've been doing a lot of work around accessibility recently.
Okay.
So, and that's a space I was a little less familiar with before I came to UNICEF, and I've gotten to learn a lot about, which has been really exciting. There is a cohort of companies I'm working with that are creating communication technologies for children with speech impairments. And that's been really, really exciting because these companies are in this space, there tends to be a lot of siloed work done and a lot of proprietary solutions. So the solutions aren't reaching children, the most vulnerable children who really need them.
Right.
And it's really exciting to be bringing on companies developing open source solutions that can really leverage the different features they're all building.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a company from Argentina, a company from China, and one from India. And they're working together really, really well. And we have great mentors who are experts in the space who are also advising them and advising us.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about what's going to come out of this because I think they could really build a couple of products for the youth that we work with, the children that we serve, that's actually going to work.
Yeah.
And this has been a space that has been very, very neglected.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to see what the potential impact could be.
Awesome. So I also definitely need to allocate time. You've been, you know, such an amazing asset and active member with the Hive New York City Learning Network for quite some time. And I would love to just kind of talk about your experience and your involvement with the network. And if you want to share anything that really stood out to you that you're really proud and just kind of want to highlight.
Yeah, wow, the Hive really had a great impact on my on my own professional development as an educator, but just my career trajectory and better defining the work that I wanted to do in this space. Mm-hmm. And like just so many great friends who I could talk to about the work that we're doing and opportunities to collaborate.
Yeah.
I have like such a great space in my heart for the Hive Learning at Work. I think, so one of the projects I'm most proud of is the Young Innovators Squad. It was a collaboration when I was at Global Kids. It was a collaboration with the New York City Parks Department, in which we were taking sort of underutilized Parks Department spaces, recreational centers, and working with a group of really fantastic youth who were youth leaders, we were co-designing these sort of monthly workshops.
Okay.
And trying to bring in youth who weren't really participating in these types of programs. And it was really, for me, it was really the first time I had ever co-designed a program with a group of youth.
Yeah.
Like over a couple of months.
Right.
Where we were like working on Google Docs together and having weekly calls and like meeting. And it was great. And I learned so much about how to work with young people in like really work with them.
Right.
So like really co-designing and being collaborative. And, you know, making sure that they're front and center and that they're developing their leadership skills and understanding, like, as an adult, where you know, opportunities for you to come in and sort of how to support them. That was a really great experience for me to sort of learn how to do that.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky. They made it easy for me because they were amazing.
Yeah.
And I think it was great. I saw there were youth who would come, who came maybe to the first or second event, who ended up coming to the third, fourth event. And that was really exciting to see.
Yeah.
And they were really drawn to the other young people who were organizing the events.
Yeah.
And so that really told me, like, you know, if you're trying to do recruitment, if you're trying to get young people engaged in programming, it's really important to work with other young people.
Yeah.
That was a great lesson learned for me. Another reason I think that the Hive Learning Network was so fantastic and is so fantastic is there's, I think in like the sort of STEM, STEAM makerspace in general, there's a tendency for us to design programs from a place that can be sometimes very siloed. In the sense that, like, we teach problem solving to sort of, like, build things and make things to solve, like, technical problems.
Right.
Only.
Right.
And I think what I love about the Hive is that it's not just that. It's so much more than that.
Yeah.
You have so many organizations that are using making not to just, you know, use Arduinos to build XYZ.
Right.
Right? And solving, teaching kids how to solve problems that aren't just technical problems,
right,
but world or global problems.
Yeah.
And learning how to communicate with different communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like that type of practice is really, really important.
Yeah.
And that takes me kind of back to my childhood and thinking about my own identity as someone who loved to make and create.
Yeah.
But like was very much drawn to the arts, but also like social activism.
Yeah.
And I think that making and social activism are very much linked. But sometimes we don't work hard enough to make those links. Or we just forget that it's there.
Yeah.
It's maybe hard. It seems hard to do, but it's really not. And I think that was something that a lot of organizations in the Hive did really well.
Yeah.
That I don't, to be honest, don't see outside of the Hive as much. It's
very
sort of like workforce development, STEM, you know, workforce of the future, skills,
right,
and not really thinking about, not thinking about other skills that are not necessarily tech folk, you know, tech based.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, you see, I think, you know, the students or the youth respond in a different way when, like, the context of the program has the, like, the focus is not the tool, learning the tool. It's kind of, you know, what you can do with the tool. And if you're tackling an issue, you know, the community issue, societal issue that is important to you, then you can do some amazing things with whatever that tool it is in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, we've had programs like that, like some app development programs where we kind of frame it in that way. And the participants in the program, they end up knowing more about kind of the software than we know. You know, we
Absolutely.
Kind of laid the foundation of like, you know, here's the interface, here you can do this, you can do that. But once they start kind of building and they're kind of really motivated to tackle that topic and that issue, they start, you know, doing some really, really amazing, you know, work, amazing things.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it just, it's also more inclusive, I think, in terms of like the language we use and the way we design our programs when we're thinking about making as like generally problem solving. And it's not about problem solving a type of problem, but problem solving in general. I think that makes it much more inclusive.
Right.
I think that's really, really important when we think about the programs that we're creating and that we're designing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, Ariam, I'm so glad that we had this opportunity to catch up. It's been too long, and you're honestly a true inspiration, and I wish you much continued success in everything you do. I know you're doing such amazing work. And I wish you all the best. Is there something that you want to maybe highlight or point out that maybe we haven't got a chance to chat about? Does anything comes to mind?
Ooh, I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like there's so much amazing work you did. I hope we got a chance to talk about everything.
I think we talked about a lot.
Okay.
I'm really happy to share everything that I did.
Okay.
I think that I'm working on. I think...
Where could people, if they want to learn more about some of the projects and work that you're doing, is there digital spaces that they can kind of check?
So I have a blog.
Okay.
It's not great.
Okay.
I'm working on my documentation.
Yeah.
It's called Ariam's Arcade.
Awesome.
Okay. Ariamsarcade.com. So there I like try to blog now and then about things that inspire me.
Yeah.
Related to some of the work that I'm doing.
Awesome.
So that's a
Check
space.
That out.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Anthony. You're the best.
What a great conversation. Thank you all so much for listening. And please rate, review, subscribe, and share the Spark Chat podcast. As always, I wish you all my best. And do stay tuned for additional content. Take care, everybody. All right, so if you're still with us, we're at that portion where we're kind of get to know our guests even a little bit more. And so, Ariam, if you could instantly become an expert in something, what would it be and why?
Okay, I think I would be a botanist because
nice.
I love plants.
Yeah.
And I have plants, and I'm not the best at keeping them alive, which is depressing. So... I would become an expert because I have a genuine interest in them, but also like financially, it's a good investment.
sure.
So yeah, I think I would be a botanist.
Awesome. Knowing what you know now and your kind of rich experience and kind of traveling the world, what advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think... Okay, so I think I would give my 18, if I was really, I would give my 18-year-old self the same advice I probably would give myself now, which is to continue to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that I think when I was 18, I was always excited and up for taking risks. And going on new adventures. And I think, like, as you get older, you kind of, like, sometimes can withdraw from wanting to do that because you want a routine and you want stability and that's comfortable. But I think that, I think it's really important to always, if you have sort of, I call it a belief base, if you have a base or foundation of beliefs and you always make your, and that can always change,
right?
But if you make decisions that are always stemming from that foundation, mm-hmm. I think you're always going to make the right decisions, or close to the right decisions. Yeah. Like sometimes we make the wrong decisions and we fail, but then we learn later, like that was the best wrong decision I ever made because I learned so much from that failure and I'm so happy about what I learned, right? And that's great. but I think like, even if that means taking a really big risk in a time in your life when it doesn't like seem right in a material way, if it's really aligned to your sort of foundation, then maybe it is the risk that you should take. Mm. So, yeah, I think just
great advice for any age.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what I would say to myself now and to my 18-year-old self.
Great.
I think.
Well, again, Aryan, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anthony.